having taught the subject so many times, I'm afraid if I had notes in front of me, I would spend too much time on some one aspect and not cover an enormous subject. We wish then to talk about God. The first thing that I think we should address ourselves to is to see something about the God of history. The God, in other words, who is believed in by man's religion. All religion believes in some kind of God. As a matter of fact, even where, say, as among the primitives, they believe in a variety of deities. Even there, at least four aspects of God always appear. This is now my 20th year of teaching comparative religion, which I'm teaching in Boston to the daughters of St. Paul. It's the first time I've had a whole class, the whole course, both semesters is being televised. At any rate, delightful course, a good audience, and a subject that I love. So that, out of teaching now for 20 years, man's religious systems, and there are many religions, I have found that in all religions, there are certain features of the deity that are common to whatever religion the people profess. There are, first of all, ideas about what we would call transcendence. Somehow, every religion believes that what we call God and whatever name they give him or them, even when they are plural, that this being is transcendent. Somehow, he is superior to everything that man experiences. The notion of supremacy and of a total otherness. Somehow, all religions sense that there is a being in the universe that is totally different from everything and everyone that we experience. So the first quality in the deity of man's religion is transcendence. Totally above, totally different. Second, that somehow in ways that they explain often in crude fashion, you read some of the creation epics of the ancient Babylonians, and you wonder how people could come by those ideas. But they're not too bad. When you analyze them, you find out somehow the world of space and time is the effect of this being, that in our vocabulary is somehow the cause. So the first quality of the God of man's religion, and this is ancient religions that have gone out of existence, the Akkadians, the Ugaritic people, the Babylonians, the Greeks and Romans, all the existing religions, whether Christian or non-Christian, first transcendence. Secondly, that somehow this deity is the maker of everything outside of him. He will not use the words that we use, creator, of all things visible and invisible, and less still, making the world out of nothing, but they do believe that somehow this being is not only above and totally different, the two qualities of transcendence, above and totally different, and secondly, that he is somehow the cause of everything else, which then is the effect. Third, among these religions, some of course are closer to what we believe and others quite some distance from our faith. But they all also believe that man somehow depends on this deity. Prayer to the deity is universal in mankind. There is no religion, never has been, that did not invoke whatever they called him or them. And somewhat surprisingly, among the so-called polytheistic religions that have a multiplicity of gods, we find, and this is good to hear historically, that polytheism is a decadence in man's religious culture. Man was not originally polytheistic. He was originally monotheistic, one God. In any case, even in the most extreme polytheistic cultures, say of Africa, you find a substratum of belief in what they call, to use our vocabulary, the high God. A deity who is above and beyond all the other deities, whom they may not as often invoke as they will the lesser spirits, but that somehow this deity is interested in man, needs to be both propitiated and invoked. Propitiated to avoid evil, invoked to obtain good. And in their own, sometimes primitive ways, they will have among the lesser deities the good gods and the bad gods. The good gods you go to, well, for what you want that is good. The bad gods you also better go to placate them, sometimes at a very great cost, not excluding human sacrifice. And you won't mind my saying this to a mainly feminine audience. Most of the evil deities of the pagan world are women. They're goddesses. Good to hear, isn't it? Just a simple fact of religious history. And they are the most demanding in sacrifice. In fact, all the goddesses who are evil, not all, because there are good goddesses too, but most of the evil deities are women. That is, they're goddesses. But as far as I know, all those who demand blood sacrifice are goddesses. Including, for example, newborn offspring. In fact, as I read the history of our contemporary abortive culture, from my vantage point, I call this the worship of women as goddesses, who demand as the price of their freedom human life. Right? finally, in the religions of all of man's history, somehow the God is the one on whom each person's destiny depends. He is therefore not only somehow a provider in this life, but one's goal in existence depends on the deity. On rare occasion in the pre-Christian and, of course, non-Judaic world, among the Greeks, and among them especially Plato, there was just a momentary insight in his work that you may have heard about, Symposium, in which he rose to the heights of seeing not only that the deity provides for man's destiny, but he is man's destiny. That's Plato, 300 years before Christ. In any case, the range and variety of insights is bewildering. But those four features stand out. Among the religions of man, there are three that are clearest. There are three religions that are clearest about who God is and what man's relationship to the deity should be. And they are, in chronological sequence, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. All three are, at least in their premises, monotheistic. And thus you find some profound insights, as we know in Judaism and as we believe in Christianity, but surprisingly also in Islam, and just for the record, the five proofs for God's existence that Thomas Aquinas canonized in the 13th century are based in large measure on the study of the great Muslim philosophers. Papers and theses that I've got from my students, where I've had assigned the subject, because by assigning subject to graduate students, they would often do a great deal of research that, well, they got credit for it, and I learned something. I told them what to do, where to go. In any case, the debt to Islam is greater than most of us realize. The Muslim idea of Allah, as they call him, is very clear. Sadly, they do not believe that Allah became man. And therefore, the only name they will give Jesus, whom they call Isa, is Ibn Maryam, son of Mary, but never Ibn Allah, son of God. Sad, but true. Nevertheless, that one God they believe in, not only firmly, but as we know, militantly. The over 100 million monotheists in an ocean of polytheism in India, thanks, if we should express gratitude, to the Muslims that made sure Allah and faith in Him was believed in. Otherwise, well, you had your choice. You either became a Muslim or you were dispatched. So the three religions of monotheism in world history are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, each depending on the other. Fascinating subject when you teach, for example, the concept of God in Islam, and spent about 3 weeks in lecturing on the beautiful insights, short always, of our own revealed understanding of who God really is. But what they have is good. For example, they have the 6 days of creation. And the very word Islam, I like to say this, means surrender. The Arabic word for surrender, Islam, Allah, surrender to Allah. Not a bad name for a religion. In fact, once when I was lecturing in Canada on the Eastern religions to an audience at the university there, afterwards some of the questioners wondered if I was a Christian. I spoke so favorably about the non-Christian world. Well, I assure them I am a Christian. But it's well to know what these other people believe so that we don't continue calling them infidels or pagans. Want to use the word? Go ahead. Quietly among ourselves. God's grace has been active in the whole world. They too have been touched by Christ. The Muslims all believe in Mary's virginity. I wish all Christians did. And you better believe it if you know what's good for you. So much then for in man's religion. In Christianity, we always distinguish regarding God between God as one and God as triune. Of course, it's the same God. But we've always got to be seeing things from different perspectives. There are no perspectives in God, for there have to be perspectives in us at looking at God. The first perspective is to look at God as one. The moment we say that, we mean He is one in nature. It answers to the question, what is God? Whereas God is three answers to the question of who is God. Thus, among ourselves, however many there are in class today, if I were to ask, what are we? What would be the answer? We are all human beings. Our nature is human. All right? Our substance, that which makes us what we are. How many human natures are there in this room? We hope just one. If I ask, however, who is in this class? The answer would be, well, each one of us could say, well, I am. And she would say, I am. And I'd insist, I am too. That's the person. In other words, the answer to the question, what an intelligent being is, identifies its nature. The answer to the question of who he or she is identifies the person. There are then three persons, three whos, if you wish, in God, but only what? One what? One nature. Regarding the nature of God, the most exhaustive and authoritative declaration of what God is was given to us by the First Vatican Council. It arose as the result of controversy over the nature of God by then many unbelievers, mainly pantheists, in the late 18th and 19th centuries, among whom the most famous was Hegel, a German pantheist, except for whom there would not be Marxism or communism in the world today. Marx built on Hegel. Hegel was condemned by the First Vatican Council. Good to hear that. That's years before the rise of communism, at least as we now know it in the modern world. How prophetically the church saw the need for identifying what God is. Let me read. You might call this the definition of God. You all have copies, don't you, of the church teachers? If you have a copy handy, would you read it with me? What I'd like to do, you don't need to, but if you have it, I will read it myself. But as I read, I will pause and make comments, because it's not too long, but contains just about everything. The Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church believes and professes that there is one true and living God, the Creator and Lord of heaven and earth. Notice, only one true God. There can be many false gods. Every false god is a product of man's imagination. He is a living God, therefore one who is as living as we are, and infinitely more, because he is God and the Creator and Lord of heaven and earth. Notice, not just Creator. In St. Ignatius' vocabulary, his most frequently used name for God was Lord, Dominus. Now, in our democratic society, we may have a little difficulty wrapping our minds around the word Lord. Well, difficulty or not, we better wrap our minds around that concept. There is a Lord. He's in charge. Our English word dominate comes from dominus. God dominates the world, and we dare not question his domination. He is all-powerful, eternal, unmeasurable, incomprehensible, and limitless in intellect and will and in every perfection. He can do whatever he wants. He never began and will never end. He cannot be measured either by space or even by the mind, because there is no standard by which to measure God. He is the standard of everything. Nothing is the norm for him. Incomprehensible. To be able to comprehend God would be to have to be God. No one but he fully understands himself, which is what comprehension means. Limitless in intellect. He knows everything. He knows
the span of the divine knowledge is the actualness. What is the actual? everything that ever was, everything that is, and everything that will be. It's called the actual. As far as God is concerned, it is. At the other extreme, he knows all the possibles. What are the possibles? All the things that could be, but never were, are not, and never will be. But as though that's not enough, God also knows the future of us. A phrase, if anybody can find this word in the dictionary, well, I'll say three rows. Find me a dictionary that has this word. I mean a standard, you know, unabridged, whatever. What are the future? They are midway between the actuals and the possible. They depend on human freedom. God knows not only all that was, is, and will be. He knows not only everything that could be, but won't be. He also knows all the things that might have been, but won't be. Depending on what decisions the by now billions of human beings have made. Are we clear? Think of all the things that could have happened if we had made other decisions. If our mothers had met another man, we'd be different people, right? If yesterday, instead of coming to Chicago, I called up and said, sorry, I can't make it. That's a future of us. It is something that depends on freedom, but never occurs because the decision is not made. Am I clear? This too is part of the scope of divine knowledge. When then the church tells us limitless in intellect, it sure is.
Limitless in will, whatever he wants, provided it does not contradict his nature, he can do. Could he fill the empty chairs just by an act of the will? Could he empty the seated chairs and we'd all disappear? We hope it won't happen. Could it? The whole universe depends on the divine will. And yet, mystery of mysteries, sometimes we actually have to struggle with ourselves to conform to that divine will. Isn't it scary that we even dare to question? Except for his will, we wouldn't even have a will to will with. He is limitless in every perfection. Since he is one unique spiritual substance, entirely simple, no parts to God, and unchangeable, he must be declared really and essentially distinct from the world. May I tell you, the most insidious and vicious heresy infecting the Catholic Church today is right here. The claim that somehow God is not unchangeable. And what comes to the same thing, that God and the world are not completely and totally distinct. You've heard about Teilhard de Chardin, my Jesuit confrere who died in the same community of which I am now a member in New York. He died a member of St. Ignatius Community on 83rd Street and Park in Manhattan. He's one of the few men whose writings the Holy See has forbidden Catholics to read without, and even if you read them, with permission. Do not read them without direction. Yet, in one seminary after another, in one Catholic book list after another, you find Chardin, title after title, and people smile. Well, he inspires me. Maybe he does. In other words, this has deeply penetrated the Catholic Church. To make sure that the God we worship is a God who is in no way dependent on the world. Perfectly happy in himself and by his very nature. How we've got to keep repeating that. Of course, there are all kinds of passages in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, about God being made happy and God being made angry. But we've got to know what that scripture means. There is no possible way in which we could make God happier than he already is. And inexpressibly exalted over all things that exist or can be conceived other than himself. You don't measure your mind and say, well, since I can't grasp this, I don't really understand it. Therefore, I don't accept it. Oh, no. And the real test of our faith is believing in God. So much for that. There are two ways in which both God's existence and his attributes can be known. One by reason, the other by revelation. The fundamental reason why God must exist is because the world exists, and the world is not its own explanation. How do we know that? Well, in the visible universe, no one would question that man stands at the peak of the universe of which we are a part. Yet, this very peak of the visible universe, we know, and we don't have to read a book or make an act of faith, we know that there was a time when we did not exist. Sometimes our parents or others have to remind us about certain antics that we perform, certain silly things we said. You look at a baby picture of yourself and we just hope nobody else sees it. But we know that 9 months before we were born, we were not. Now, the most simple syllogism that man could state: what did not exist need not exist. All right? Therefore, as far as we are concerned, we clearly are not the explanation of our own existence. And to say that our parents brought us into being is dodging the issue. Because that part of us, namely our minds and wills, they didn't give us. Reason, therefore, from a variety of perspectives, can establish the fact that the world is, as we call it, contingent, dependent, and pushing it back a million years with evolution, that doesn't solve it. How did it get started? Does it have an explanation? Yes, it does. Is the world its own explanation? Well, you can't say that if you're rational. In any case, God's existence can be established from reason. I brought with me, just to show you, this is a good book dealing with God and His creation by the Dominican Priory Press and the treatment of proving God's existence from reason is very neatly and not too learnedly, so to speak, treated in this book. Right. From Revelation, we know that God exists from the fact that time and again He insisted not only that He existed, but that He was the only true God. And in fact, all the punishment for a century of the Jews was mainly due to the fact that He had abandoned the one true God whom they were told to honor and worship, and no one else. And incidentally, as we reread Isaiah or Jeremiah, and smile perhaps at those Jews being so naive as to lapse in their honor and worship of Yahweh, and going after you name it what, the golden calves of Jewish history. Let's not smile too soon, because idolatry, Augustine says, is the most pervasive temptation of human nature. Our fundamental temptation is to idolatry, to worship creatures instead of God. Money, prestige, sex, whatever. In any case, idolatry is the most fundamental sin that man can commit. And in the first commandment, this is what the Lord made sure was first. I am the Lord your God. You will not have other gods beside me. The attributes can be established from reason. Faith, as we read from the First Vatican Council, expands on those attributes and develops them enormously. We know far more about God, even in His one nature, from Revelation, than we could ever know about this one God from just reason. In other words, it is not just the Trinity that Revelation gives us. It is also a much deeper, clearer, and much wider understanding of what kind of a being God is that we know on faith and we could ever have known from just using our reason. There are three fundamental attributes that are knowable both by reason and from revelation. And all the divine attributes ultimately reduce themselves to these three. They are the attribute of wisdom, of love, and of power. Of wisdom, referring in our human language to the mind of God. Love, referring again, humanly speaking, to the will of God. And power, as far as we can understand it, referring to God's free capacity to do what He wants outside of Himself, the divine power does not refer to God within himself. Wisdom and love do. Power refers to what God can do outside of himself, and the word we now have and have for centuries, he is Almighty. Before I leave this, now I would like to, before we take our break, finish this part so there at least a logical break between, I feel ashamed of myself, trying to cover the divinity in less than 2 hours. But there's so much of the faith to see, and we have just begun to start. In order to understand this God in his nature, and it's not enough to say merely that I know God, because I'm to grow in my understanding of who God is. There are 4 principal ways of growing in the knowledge of God. Now this will, of course, refer to the Trinity too. But for our purpose, mainly, to understanding what God is. The first is by comparing God with creatures. God can be known, and much can be known about him, by comparing him with creatures. How do we know that God must have wisdom? Because there's wisdom in the universe. How do we know God must be good? Because there's goodness in the world. How do we know God must have beauty? Because there's beauty in the world. What you see immediately, and I'd like to have these lectures as theological as they are, to also be somewhat practical. You see the importance of people having contact with goodness and love and beauty. Otherwise, you will find it hard even to know that there is a God who is good. The phrase we use in Latin, let me give it to you, ascensio mentis in Deo, the ascent or rise of the mind towards God from creatures. We can rise by comparing what we see in creatures, knowing that he is their maker. Somehow, what is in the effect must also be in the cause. Makes sense. Secondly, contrast. God can be known by contrasting what we know of creatures and what, after some reflection, we know cannot be true of God. For example, there is wisdom among human beings, but as every teacher knows, there's also a lot of ignorance. So there cannot be ignorance in God. We know, for example, that as composites of body and soul, we are born, we live, and then we die. We are mortal. God is immortal. And so of everything that we affirm of God, and that's the paradox, we come to know God, first of all, by comparing him and rising from creatures to himself. We secondly learn God by contrasting him. There is sin in creatures. There can be no sin in God. Thirdly, we come to